Hey guys, and welcome back to Tennis 360, the podcast where we talk about all things tennis. My name is Anthony Hirsch.
I'm Eliza Leskett.
Welcome back to the podcast. So we've had Jannik Sinner and Danielle Collins winning the Miami Open, a 1000 event, one of the biggest of the year. Great wins for both these players. For Danielle Collins, what a win for her, the biggest of her career in her farewell season. Really exciting to see. She hit big the whole week, played at a very high level. And I was very excited to see Collins win. I know that you were excited to see her finally come through with a big win as well, because I think she's been knocking at the door a while for something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think any of us would have picked Collins as a winner at the start of this Masters tournament. She did make it into my power rankings inside the top 10 last week. I mean, she was playing some formidable tennis, and we know that Collins is, you know, one of those characters on the ATP tour. When she has a, you know, when she's playing big tennis, she's pretty unbeatable for even the world's best players. She pushed Świątek at the Australian Open this year to the very brink. She has played some of her best tennis, honestly, this year in her farewell season. Maybe that's been an extra motivator for her. And I think playing in her home state, her kind of home tournament as a farewell tour, maybe just kind of allowed her to play pretty free. And she plays the type of tennis that you have to play free and feel free to be able to execute. And she was ultra dominant after the first round, where she dropped one set. After that, she didn't drop a single set. And she really looked like she came into that final thinking that she had a good chance against Rybakina. She wasn't winning that head-to-head and had taken a couple recent losses against Rybakina, but those matches were tight. They were not kind of two sets, straight sets that were clean for Rybakina. Their battles often went three sets. And so I think she fancied herself to, you know, be able to push Rybakina. And the key was really securing that first set and making it difficult for Rybakina, who had spent 3 hours more on court over the course of the week.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very good stuff from her. I thought her back end was amazing throughout the whole week. Yeah. I really thought she looked confident. She looked like she had a huge desire to perform here in front of the home crowd. I think maybe the fact that it is her farewell season, I think it's put a little bit of less pressure off her shoulders, she has less pressure on her. And yeah, I think that that's been a big key. And I think a lot of these, you know, I don't think it's coincidence, and it's been very good to see. But yeah, I think the whole season, like you said, she got close against Świątek in Australia. She got close against Rybakina in Abu Dhabi. But yeah, in Abu Dhabi, it just felt like she didn't play the big points nearly as well as she did here. In the match here, Rybakina converted on 1 out of 11 break point chances that she got. In Abu Dhabi, it was 6 out of 12. Which was a lot of breaks. That match was a whole lot of breaks. But Collins throughout this tournament was just so mentally solid. She won like 12 sets consecutively without dropping more than 3 games in any set. And she was just dominant. And, you know, I think played one of the higher levels we've seen the whole year out of anybody on the women's side, which is something you always like to see from a player that maybe you're not expecting, but is also very exciting for somebody who, you know, is looking for that fairy tale run. And yeah, I thought it was a very good tournament from her in the final. I think Collins is a great athlete. I think Rybakina is a great athlete. They love staying on top of the baseline attacking. We actually had a lot of that throughout the tournament. Also Alexandrova, who beat Świątek as well. 6-2, 6-4. I thought she played unbelievable in that match, taking so many returns right off the rise.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not always super consistent, but when she shows up, her level is amazing and showing again the type of game to beat Świątek. But we saw a lot of that, and I felt like, you know, Rybakina's not used to that, playing against a player who can do the same thing but right back at her, and Collins performed that at such an incredible level. Just being able to stay on the baseline, generate more and more pace. And, yeah, like I said, just played the big points well. In Abu Dhabi, she allowed Rybakina back in a few too many times. She should have won the match, I think, there at least. You know, giving herself more of a chance. She was up a set and a break a couple of times in that match, and she let them go pretty easy. Here, I felt like maybe sometimes you need losses like that. I felt like that kind of propelled her for better here and for a better tournament here, and I feel like she's had lots of losses like that. Now she's gotten over the line. She looked confident, and she's already up to a good start in Charleston as well. So, I mean, I think that she is absolutely on a tear right now.
Yeah, and there's certainly two players that are not going to back off of the baseline. I think the majority of the points won in that match were under 5-shot rallies. This was really first strike tennis, which was great to see on the women's tour. We are used to seeing kind of at least, you know, one of the two players being willing to like play a little bit more defensively and look to extend the rallies in the hope to win some more points as you know, against a Rybakina or a Collins type character. But these two in their strategy are committed to exactly the way that they're going to play and try and bulldoze their way through. And I think Collins executed that with, you know, relative poise, needed a couple of match points to get through it in the end, but tricky second set there. It could have easily kind of gotten out of hand and been a bit topsy-turvy and a bit difficult, but she held on to that break and you know, served it out well in the end under a big pressure moment. And so just really happy for her that she can, you know, finish off her career on you know, with a deserved Masters 1000 title. Many forget that she did reach the Australian Open final just a few years ago, lost to Ash Barty, who's one of women's greatest players. So I think she'll be, you know, beyond stoked looking back on her career that she got the opportunity to win this one and to do it at home and in front of friends and family. So let's see what she can do on the clay court season. I think she'll really be looking to end off her, you know, season at the US Open with a big bang on the hard courts. But hopefully she'll stay healthy through the clay and the grass court season, and we'll see her back on US soil, hopefully competing at a high level towards the end of the year.
Yeah, totally. And I think also just a shout out to Rybakina, who I was struggling with different things throughout the week. She was dealing with illness and she was dealing with other things. So, I mean, for her to win four three setters, make it to the final, I think she likes these conditions, but even she said that they're different than they were last year. It was definitely a bit slower conditions than it was last year, and I think a little bit less humid than it was last year. So they're just not playing quite as quick and not really to the way that Rybakina likes as much, but she still found a way through a lot of matches, which shows to kind of her mental strength throughout that's really improved and at a top tier level at this point.
100%.
So yeah, shout out to Rybakina big time, and she got through a really tough Azarenka, who also had a really good run in this tournament as well on the WTA side. And yeah, there's just some really good matches just throughout the tournament from just really hard hitting players. And it was good to see Alexandrova, Collins, these players that every now and again can have a good have a good win, but for them to have semifinal and final kind of runs, I thought that was really good to see for players with really high peaks. And I think, you know, it gave us really good high level matches throughout the week. For me, the highest level, I don't know what you would say, but for me, the highest level that I saw was Sakkari taking on Rybakina in the quarterfinals. I thought was an incredible match, with Sakkari saving a couple match points. So I just wanted to say shout out Sakkari, because she's back. I think she's back.
Yeah, look, I think Rybakina will be really pleased that she made another final here, and certainly coming off the back of, you know, pulling out of Indian Wells, and has you know, already has 22 match wins on the season, has multiple titles already this season and reached multiple finals. I think it just shows, you know, for her personally, it's okay. You know, you have a period of time, a week, 8 days. She said she wasn't training, she wasn't well. Of course, at the elite levels of sport, not training for 8 days can make a big difference, but at the same time, it's 8 days, and somebody like her can still turn up and be world number four or world number three and reach a final of a Masters 1000 tournament by just grinding and working her way through the challenges. So it just, as you say, underscores her resilience and mental toughness here and ability to just sort of dig in, stay calm, and trust the process. I also thought she really had a good positive outlook on it and was like, look, you know, see this as a positive result and a positive stepping stone and sort of wrapping up the hard court season. And I'm happy with that, you know, as a result to reach a final. So that'll do a lot for her going into the clay season. And with regards to Sakkari, you know, I felt like it was a high level match. She worked her way back into it in that second set and then started off the third set in a really negative way again. And so I feel like I'm seeing glimpses of Sakari making a turn and, you know, making adjustments that I think are really going to be beneficial to her game long term. And then still flashes of the old Sakari that feel very negative. Hopefully the coaching change with Coach Witt is going to make a difference in the long run in terms of stamping out some of that kind of negative behavior, because she certainly worked her way back in that second set and you kind of thought, oh gosh, like, you know, she could cause an upset here, and then just lost the focus. It felt like early in the third, and from there on, it was sort of a runaway train with Rybakina, who recognized that and stepped on the gas pretty quickly. So some notes there for Sakari, but certainly glimpses of her, you know, playing at her best level.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's the disappointing mix that is Maria Sakari, is the fact that we saw those positive signs, but also with the negative signs for saving four match points. But then also, like you said, right as soon as the third set started, she kind of fell off the tank a little bit of how well she was playing. And she served so well at the end of the second set, but she ended with eight double faults and she just started serving way worse towards the end of the third set. So towards the start of the third set. So hopefully she can, keep it more consistent and find the game to beat the top players again. Because surely I think at this point we're going to start seeing her in quarterfinals, semifinals again. I think it's about getting that to that next kind of hurdle at this point for Maria Sakari. But yeah, some good runs there. Danielle Collins, shout out to her. I mean, against Rybakina, also against Aleksandrova in the semi, she had just Aleksandrova beat Swiatek, like I said, playing phenomenal, and it was like 6-2, 6-3. And it was just unbelievable because Aleksandrova was smashing the ball as well, but Collins was saying right back at you. So shout out to Collins, just powering through. I really think it was her desire and willpower to win this tournament that she was like, I'm going to do this. And I think she went out and did it. And it was a fairy tale run, but she made it happen. And that's a great thing to see. And then on the ATP side, we had Jannik Sinner getting the win over Grigor Dimitrov in the final. Dimitrov came out in this tournament playing, I personally think, the best tennis I've ever seen him play. It was definitely up there in terms of level, definitely some of the most complete tennis he's ever played off the serve and off the return as well. And I was just flabbergasted by how aggressive he was just in every facet of the court, but everything was working and going in. It was amazing. Against Alcaraz, he was returning from, I think, like 3 or 4 feet inside the baseline. He was hitting return winners, stepping in. So Dimitrov played phenomenal. The fact that Sinner could beat Dimitrov while losing just 4 games, beat Medvedev while losing 3 games in the semis, just shows that Sinner, I think, is playing world number one level right now and is the best player in the world. Jannik is playing unbelievable. I think right now it's almost objectively a fact that Sinner is the best player in the world. And I think that that's something that we're just not used to saying. Even in 2022, when Alcaraz picked up, people are saying, well, he did, but Djokovic didn't play Australia, didn't play this, didn't play that. There's nothing to say. I think there's very little that you can say at this point that really says that right now, Sinner is not the best player in the world. Which is crazy. That's crazy, and it's true. And Sinner played an unbelievable final. Just so aggressive. Dimitrov's aggressiveness, and especially his return, was completely neutral. Sinner didn't lose a single first serve point the whole first set. He ended up winning 88% of his first serve points. Also on defense, he defended just as well as Dimitrov. It's a bit annoying because it's almost like a Djokovic-esque quality. Everything is just a little bit too good, a little bit too effective. Every single shot that he has, and it's not always, it's not always a shot that's peaking and amazing, every other game. It's that every shot is just at a level that's a little bit too good at the top for the highest level players. And Jannik just so complete at this point, and I think he's the best player in the world.
I would agree. I think Sinner has certainly had a meteoric rise since the US Open last year and has put a number of runs and performances together that would certainly warrant that description of being the number one player in the world. And certainly in 2024, having only lost one match this year against another fantastic player who was defending his title and looked like he was starting to have some fun. There was also question marks a little bit about Sinner's physicality on that day in particular, but nothing to take away from Alcaraz's performance at Indian Wells. I just think that Sinner is, as you say, he's playing with a level of intensity that doesn't necessarily mean every shot is this stellar, crazy shot, but the placement, the accuracy, the intention behind everything that he's doing is so penetrative against his opponents. They feel like there's nothing they can do. Like, they just don't have many answers. I mean, there were multiple moments where Dimitrov, you know, came to the net and had opportunities to put balls away and didn't. And it wasn't because I thought Dimitrov wasn't playing well. I think that Sinner and his movement improvement and his shot selection and shot placement has improved so much that it's making his opponents have to go for the finest of margins in order to feel like they can win the point for sure, or not leave themselves in a vulnerable position. And so it was causing unforced errors from Dimitrov's end that, you know, to the basic eye may have seemed like, oh, Dimitrov isn't playing very well. I don't think that was the case. I think he still brought a high level to this final. I just think Sinner was, you know, playing in a different dimension and was asking questions of his opponent that was just a little bit too hard to execute. And not just this final performance, but that semifinal performance against Medvedev. I mean, he's now got five wins in a row against Medvedev, where last year we were talking about a head-to-head that was significantly in Medvedev's favor. So it just shows evidence of that turnaround that happened post-US Open last year. Something or multiple things have clicked for him that have created this level of confidence that he feels like, I've got multiple ways that I can beat these guys now. And that's what makes him so dangerous as well, is that it's not just one shot. It's not just one thing that he's doing well that's allowing him to win matches. It's kind of immaculate, clean performances across the board and this sort of mental resolve of like, okay, like, if it doesn't work this way, I'm going to try this way. And always having another way to approach the game, I think, is also what turns a player, you know, into that elite status. And certainly given Djokovic's form at the moment and where he's been at this year, he's not really a part of the conversation in terms of being the number one player, despite, you know, reaching a semifinal in Australia at a poor performance at Indian Wells and, you know, obviously skipped out on Miami as well. And I think if you asked anybody on the ATP Tour on the top 10 who's the number one guy right now, it wouldn't really be a question. So, you know, Sinner is truly the guy to beat. It'll be interesting to see if things shake up at all as we head into the clay court season. But to collect his second Masters title in this way, in such an emphatic manner, was ultra impressive.
Yeah, I agree. The amount of different ways that he can beat opponents is exactly what Medvedev pointed to after his loss.
Yeah.
He said that everything that I'm trying over the last five matches, Sinner just has a response to. Medvedev is the guy who usually wins baseline rallies. He finds a way to move inside the court, defense to offense. Sinner was winning the baseline rallies all over against Medvedev. And his defense, I think, is the biggest thing I saw in this tournament that was just unbelievably better than it was even a year ago. And Sinner loves this tournament. He loves playing in Miami. He's made three finals here. He loves the low bouncing courts. And I think they're just right up his alley in every department. But yeah, I think that, you know, his defense, in order to make it so that he can get into more aggressive positions and work his way back into the points, is just is working at such a stellar level. And he's also, the variety he's added into this game, like his match against Medvedev in the semis, there were a couple moments where he was on the dead run. He managed to hit a lob over Medvedev, who's like 6'6", and get himself back to the point and win those points.
Yeah.
And it was impressive. And I was just like, this is why Sinner is now at the level he's at and playing at a level that I think is world number one kind of level. And it's just so complete. And there's really, that's a hilarious thing, right? There's no holes that you can poke into his game. I know we're both being very positive, but it's a positive kind of situation. The fact that he's only 22, and yeah, I mean, maybe sometimes he hits a little bit too central, or this or that, or the serve, first serve percentage can be higher at certain, but, or like the, you know, the net play at times, he can be more comfortable coming to net. It's very few and far in between. He's becoming nearly an unplayable player to most players. which is kind of impressive. He actually didn't start the week that hot against Griekspoor, but after that rain delay against Griekspoor in the second half of that match, turned that around, and he's just performing at such a level that is going to be very hard to beat for anybody, and that includes Djokovic, that includes Alcaraz. So, Sinner wins 42. Yeah, and then they'll speak
for themselves. It's
Sinner's
like, if you look at the data, sorry,
42 of his last 45 matches.
That's absurd. Yeah, so it just shows that, you know, it's a player, he's playing with a lot of confidence, and we look at the data and tennis analytics post the matches in terms of the score ranking of his forehand and backhand. I mean, it's in the nines pretty much every time. That's ultra elite level. And I think, as you say, that there's no holes really to poke at this point in time. Let's see how the year progresses. I'm sure there will be moments. There's always moments. And I do think he has backed up that Australian Open win in a very impressive manner. You know, to get your first Grand Slam title and then win in Rotterdam and now win in Miami. You've won, you know, just in such an emphatic manner to back up your first Grand Slam in that way and be like, no, like, I am really here. It just shows that the work he's been doing has allowed him to arrive at this place ready to sustain it. And that's what makes him a little bit different than the Alcaraz story, who, you know, came to a place so quickly, and we've talked about this before, but maybe didn't have the skill set to sustain it once people kind of figured out his game a little bit. And so he had to take a step back in order to come back to a good level. And he himself sort of talked about a bit of that pressure getting to him post Wimbledon and sort of losing a bit of the joy for it. It feels like Sinner's kind of on this like efficient machine right now. And it's like, I figured out my way to do things. I've arrived and I'm like, I'm here to stay. And now it's up to you guys to like figure it out. So I think that's also what impresses me so much about him, is his journey here he's done everything he needs to do to prepare himself for this moment, not only to get to this point, but to remain here. And that's why I expect him to just continue to rack up these types of results this season.
I think that's so well said, honestly. I think the fact that he's been through the struggle already and seeing firsthand that he needs to force his weapons to get better by losing these matches, like, oh, I need to improve my offense so that I can work through Medvedev. Oh, I need to improve my variety so I can get through Alcaraz. Oh, I need to find a way to somehow beat Djokovic mentally, figure it out. Every part of his game has been forced to get better. And I think that's the big thing that we've seen unfold. Alcaraz, it's another journey. It's another journey. That's fine, but it is different. And he's going to have to, you know, like you said, rework some of the things that he was doing in his game in order to get to that point that Sinner's at the moment. He's going to have to go through those struggles, and people are going to, you know, as when Alcaraz was doing a little bit worse than he was and getting to Australian Open quarterfinals rather than semifinals and finals, they're going to say things, but those are struggles he needs to go through. And that's what made Sinner grow. That's what Sinner grew from. So it's really well said, the fact that, you know, he's being forced to get to a better place. And that's been so good, because now he has a level of stability that has been very gradual and very, you know, moment by moment, and growing to a place that at this point feels almost unstoppable. And, you know, I think that is what we saw with a player like Djokovic. And it wasn't always pretty. Losing a lot to Federer and Nadal and going through lots of struggles early in his career, having the most double faults on tour, I think, in like 2009, hitting the drop shots rather than hitting over the backhand all the time, I think, in like 2008, and all of these things. And, you know, people wouldn't have thought that he would become, in most people's eyes, the greatest player that ever lived. That would be a mystery to a lot of players, how that would have happened. Well, he worked for it. 2010, he lost nearly every match Federer and Nadal didn't make a single Masters final. Year after that, he broke through. We can see a very similar patterns with Sinner, and I think that that's a pattern we see with a lot of all-time greats, and it's really that going through losses, then being able to turn that into wins and getting right back on track. That was what was impressive with Alcaraz and Rio getting injured and then coming back and less than a month later winning Indian Wells when very few would have expected, very few would have believed it, including Alcaraz. He probably would have been like, oh, I'm probably going to have to take a break now.
Yeah.
Nope. He went right back to work. And that's what Sinner's been able to show. And that's why I think that those two guys are going to be greats for a long time to come.
Yeah, I would agree.
And yeah, it was a great win for Sinner. And yeah, I think for Medvedev, do you think Medvedev has a problem now that he needs to figure out? And do you think he'll be able to win a lot more titles and big titles? He hasn't won a title since Rome.
Yeah, I mean, tough luck. I think it's like, I admire so much about Medvedev. I think he is showing that he's willing to try different things, have a different approach. I mean, he's doing what all of the commentators like threw at him over the past couple of years. Like, why are you standing so far back? Why this? Why that? He's throwing it all out there, and he's showing he has versatility. He's showing the mental resolve. AO was a heartbreak for him. He had multiple matches. I think his regret about Australia is not going to be the final. I think it is the matches prior to the final that probably exhausted him and made it difficult for him to get over the line. I think, you know, he didn't have much of a preseason. He admitted that. And he ended up in situations where he was playing really long five-set matches against guys he probably shouldn't have been playing five-set matches against. And so his total time on court was just disgusting. And so for that reason, I don't think he'll look at that final and believe that his level isn't good enough to beat Sinner. I do think when a player gets a comeback win against you like that in a big slam final, it gives them a bit of an edge. It gives them a bit of a mental, like, I got you, you know? And Medvedev had that edge over Sinner in the past, and now it's the momentum's gone the other way. Sport's a fickle thing. It can easily swing back the other way very quickly. You never know kind of with Medvedev what tactics he's going to be willing to try next, but you know for sure that he's not going to do the same thing again next time. So he's a smart guy, and he's going to figure out tactics that allow him to win. Now, I think where we might see a difference is, like, in order for him to win a slam or win a big tournament, he's going to have to catch one of these guys a little bit on an off day. I think that's kind of like the difference. You know, when he won his US Open title, he played a clean match against Djokovic, but Djokovic didn't play his best level. No. And so I think Medvedev is just at that point where he's been a bit, you know, unlucky. He's had Djokovic in the peak of his career. Now he's having Sinner, who we would say in tennis is treeing right now. You've got Alcaraz, who's been a bother for him. And you've got guys who, you know, really, really are playing great tennis and are just that, you know, have a few more weapons, have an ability to execute. But I don't think Medvedev is sitting there like super stressed out right now. I think he is going to approach this, you know, with intellect and in a way that, you know, works for him. But ultimately, sometimes it's that way in sport. You got to hope that you catch somebody feeling a little sore, feeling a little off that day for whatever reason, and take your opportunity and capitalize on it. Tennis is a long season. You're going to catch people in those moments. It happens. And so he'll be ready and waiting. I think that's going to be his kind of MO. He'll let the other guys shine and wait in the wings for his opportunity. And I think that is a different mentality from Medvedev than it is from somebody like Zverev. I think Zverev looks at his own career and his situation as, you know, I was supposed to be the guy after Djokovic. And that's what he truly believes. You know, that's the Zverev ego. And he lost that Grand Slam final in a painful way against Dominic Thiem. And that's had scarring for him, not just, you know, mentally, obviously, had the physical injury, but I feel like he has this thing of like, I'm turning 27. I don't have my Grand Slam title. These guys are really effing good. Like, you know, when's my time gonna be? And so I think Zverev plays with a little bit more anxiety and pressure underneath him in a visible way that I don't see from Medvedev. And that's why I think those two characters are a little bit different. So it'll be interesting to see kind of if the two of them end up in that, you know, position where they're sitting around four or five in the world, but they're having a hard time closing out and winning these tournaments, and what the difference in their approach is going to be in trying to beat these guys at the very top level.
It's interesting you say that, because I actually think a big part of that comes with the fact that I think Medvedev probably didn't expect himself to get to this point, which is part of what you were saying. Yeah. But he plays in such an unorthodox way, and he has his whole career that I literally think he didn't think he was going to become a top 10, top five player. I think Zverev, on the other hand, has a very, you know, textbook kind of just great strokes all around, great shots. And that's, you know, yeah, you would expect it from a player like Zverev who plays like that. With Medvedev, I think he's like, wow, I've already had a great career. I probably maximized out of this more than I think most people would have expected out of me. And I think that that is what is making part of the lack of absence of pressure that Medvedev is putting onto himself. That's the reason for it, is that he probably didn't even expect himself to get to this point. And it also adds to the fact of why he's so difficult to play. He plays in such a strange way, but he's able to make it work because he's so talented and because he has a good mentality on his shoulders, which I do agree is probably better than Zverev in the pressure moments. So I think that Medvedev can, you know, beat these players. We saw it against Alcaraz at the US Open last year when he went absolutely one of the best performances I've seen Medvedev play, which I don't think is controversial to say, but I think that now I won't be surprised if they come few and far in between at this point. I would agree with you. And let's see what he does. I'm just not sure that as Sinner and Alcaraz get better and the matchup struggle for him, that he's going to be able to beat these guys a lot more, even with strategy, but I'll be happy to be wrong. What I do think is that once the draw can open up for him, and if he has one of these performances where he figures it out and plays like he did against Alcaraz last year, that's when I would expect that he should have a good run or two in the future, because he's too good to not have a great performance like that and to, you know, figure it out at some point at some tournament down the road. But it'll be interesting to see how Medvedev does from here.
Yeah, I'm interested to follow his story and Zverev's story almost in tandem a little bit. I think Zverev played an elite level in Miami this week, and I think a lot of us would have expected Zverev to take care of Dimitrov. Now, I'm not saying that Dimitrov didn't play a fantastic level. He absolutely did. His serving performance against Zverev by his own standards and averages far exceeded anybody's expectations in terms of where he could perform at in that match specifically. So I think Dimitrov delivered on the day. But I do think Zverev, he didn't necessarily take care of his controllables in the pressure moments in ways that you would want to see from somebody who backs himself to be a Grand Slam contender or a Masters title contender at every single one of these events. I don't think we see the same mistakes from Medvedev, but I think we see similar challenges in what does he have to do? What level does he personally have to play at to beat a Sinner or an Alcaraz at this moment in time? As you say, when he beat Alcaraz last year, that was one of his best performances. And so I think the two of them are kind of sitting in a situation where they're lacking something. 5% difference over Sinner and Alcaraz. Is that something at 27 years of age versus 22, 21, 20 years of age that they can figure out, that they can turn around, that they can find a switch for themselves that allows them to make up that 5% deficit? Or are they going to be a part of the group that's waiting in the wings, hoping someone's injured or hoping someone has a bad day? And if I had to pick one of the two to be able to figure it out, it would be Medvedev, based on just his intellect and his approach to tennis. but I think the two of them are poised in a similar way, and that's why I'm curious to see where their paths go, if they run parallel with one another, if they face similar kind of score lines and challenges, because they're both slightly more defensive players, or, you know, whether one of them can, you know, veer off to the left and make a difference and put themselves in that elite category.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to follow. And for this week's power rankings, we have both put Sinner to the top spot, which I think would be very surprising if we didn't do that, despite Alcaraz having a great run at Indian Wells. But Alcaraz number two, Medvedev there. I have Dimitrov at number four, because Dimitrov, I thought at times, I was like, oh, that's cool. Federer didn't retire. I guess that was, I just made that up. I was like, he played so well. And not to, the Federer comparison's going to get tiresome. But he played against Alcaraz, he played out of his mind. And I really think that performance for me was one of the best performances I think I've seen of anybody of the last year. And I'll feel happy to stand on that ground. But either way, he's been playing amazing. I have him at number four. Then I got Zverev. Then I got Demonor. Some other guys made their appearances in my power rankings. Marajan, he's been playing great. He has a better win percentage at Masters, apparently, than Nadal or Djokovic. He's made the round 16 at all four that he's played at. And then I've also got Jarry, who had a great tournament, Hurkacz, and Mahac. Who do you have for your ATP ones?
Yeah, pretty similar. I still have Rude inside my top 10. I think, especially heading into clay court season, he's going to be like, I'm ready to cook. I think he's had a better hard court season than maybe he would have expected. So I've been impressed by his level. And honestly, that match versus Jarry was tight. It was great to see Jarry have a good run in Miami. I think, as we mentioned last week, there were some question marks over him this season and why he wasn't able to maintain the level he had towards the end of 2023. But I think this was one of the first tournaments where I've like really watched his game with a close eye. And you can really see that he is a player that has grown up on clay. So I'm really excited to see his level and where he goes with the clay court season coming up and coming off of a good result like this. I think he's going to, you know, bring a little bit more confidence with him, which I think is key in this part of the season. So wanted to give him a nod. And I think Marjan, same thing, similar feelings. He's climbed up a lot of ranking points. He's really showing up well at these bigger tournaments and seems to like enjoy rising to the occasion. Again, we kind of saw that name first pop up last year on the clay. So can we expect him to have a good clay court season? I certainly think he's a name that will be around.
Yeah, who has the best drop shot on tour? Is it Alcaraz or Marajan?
It very well could be Marajan.
I'd feel compelled to agree, to be honest.
Yeah, for real. So Mahac deserves the nod, but Shelton, we love to give a little nod to Ben Shelton. I'm biased. He has a decent draw in Houston this week. He's the number one seed. Let's see how he does. I still think he's a rookie on the clay. Limited experience. I expect Shelton potentially not to be in my power rankings for a little while until we head back to clay court season. So this might be the last week you see him in there. Unless he wins the title in Houston, then I will be impressed. He didn't take care of business against Musetti in Miami, and I think he'll be disappointed that he didn't set up the opportunity to play Alcaraz.
For sure.
Just didn't bring the level that evening. So certainly, could get on board with giving Mahac a nod, just knowing that Shelton is playing this week. He's kept his place in my power rankings.
And then on the women's side, Swiatek, Sabalenka, and Coco Gauff. I had Danielle Collins climbing up to four in my spot, playing incredible all week. Like I said, 12 consecutive sets, losing three games or less in every set was incredible. Not much more to say. I mean, she's had a good year all year, so she climbs to the top of my power rankings. Rybakina, Sakkari. Then I've got Azarenka. She had a great tournament. Very close match against Rybakina in the semi. She could have very well been that final. She fought so well throughout that semi. Very little to choose between them. Rybakina was serving for it. Azarenka broke back and made it 5-5 and just was fighting so well. She lost. Here's a stat. So second set against Rybakina. Rybakina won 5 points. And
yeah,
starting from so Azarenka was down 6-4 a set and also 15-30. From that point on in the set, Rybakina won 3 points starting from 15-30 in the set. So Azarenka was playing pretty well at times in this tournament. And yeah, she definitely deserves a nod. Alexandrova, kind of wanted to put her higher, but I mean, Sakkari, Rybakina, Collins, I mean, those players played amazing, and Azarenka as well. And yeah, Pagula's back in and Garcia as well. They both had good weeks, which I was happy to see that for both those players because it's good to see very different game styles, but very good to see both them competing at a high level again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my top six looks a little different, a little unchanged because I think the Collins result, as special as it was, I think I don't know what to expect from her per se on the clay. I'm not sure how consistent she's going to be there. Obviously, Charleston clay plays a little different than European clay. So she'll fancy herself, but it's always hard going from, you know, winning a Masters 1000 title to WTA 500, by the way. It's not even a 250 event. So the WTA schedule is brutal.
That is absolutely
brutal. Have had no let up since the Australian Open. It's really been wild for the women.
I don't even think it should be something that we should be talking about. Like, I think that it should be obvious for anybody who's trying to get the best out of any sport. As long as you understand what the terms mean, as soon as you say 4 WTA 1000 events in 7 weeks, should be red lights. There should be red alarms. It makes no sense. And I don't really understand what they're doing at the top. It's disrespectful to the players and it should change.
Yeah, and they have 500 to either side of that too. And not to mention they finished up the AO at the end of January. You know, it's just they had a grand slam.
Non-existent offseason as well.
Yeah, 2 500s, 4 Masters, then another 500, and then they're going to head to Europe. It's wild. I feel sorry for them.
By the way, not to add on more to that than necessary, but I would also add now we don't even have Hopman Cup or any of that. We have United Cup, which is worth 500 points. You play for your team. A lot of top players are playing. It makes no sense at all.
It makes no sense. I think the one insight here is Collins is going to be gunning for an Olympic place. I think otherwise she probably would have taken this week off. She needs a couple more points to up her ranking so she can make the team for the U.S. team for the Olympics. So that is on the mind of some players right now who are trying to qualify to compete at the Olympics. So just kind of have that in the back of your mind if you're wondering why some players' schedules are just so packed. Vika remains in my 8th spot. I mean, super impressive performance in Miami. I think she put a couple of matches together and just fell short in that tiebreak against Rybakina. It was a real shame. It just was a poor tiebreak, and I think she would admit that herself. Pagula had another good week, starting to put some better performances together. Did take out Emma Navarro, who's been on a hot streak and is also amongst the players with over 20 wins this season. So Navarro, I think it's been an interesting name to watch, and I'm curious to see how she performs this week in Charleston as well as going into the red clay. But I think she's just carrying some quiet confidence around with her at the moment, which I've really enjoyed watching. And then I gave Sloane Stephens a nod. I know that she's not, you know, necessarily had an impressive performance in Miami or Indian Wells, but Sloane Stephens, when she wants to play well, when she wants to show up, is a handful. I think she actually plays best on clay. And I think she'll fancy herself this clay court season to have a couple of good little tournaments here and there. And I wouldn't be surprised if she, you know, picked up a small title, maybe a 250 title, or gets to a semi in Charleston, for example. She likes the US audience. So she slipped into my top 10 because I'm keeping an eye on her.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think that's what makes the power rankings stand out, though, that we do every week, because You can just have it go off a gut feeling because you're watching a player and you're like, I think they'll do well. Like, yeah, it doesn't have to have that much, you know, innate logic or, you know, 52-week performance rate or even, you know, anything of that. You can just be like, you know what? I kind of think they're going to do well soon. And I like what I'm seeing from them. I think that makes this work. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we logic our way out with some of these picks, but I think it's good to just, you know, if you like a player, I think that's what makes this work. So Mirajan isn't ranked seventh, but he's seventh in my power rankings. And then for upcoming, we've got Charleston and Houston are this week. Charleston is a 500 event, big one. You know, it's a good history at that tournament. I believe it's, is it still green clay? Which I think, yes. I don't think Archer? It's red clay. Yeah. Yeah. So that is exciting in itself. I like that tournament, the way it plays.
Yeah. And great fan turnout. Really, really fun tournament. I've had a lot of really awesome things. Emma Navarro's dad owns the Charleston tournament. So tennis family. And they've really put in a lot of effort, a lot of work into making those grounds really awesome, adding stadium courts on kind of outside courts. And you can see from the pictures already that the tournament is well attended, even on a, you know, random Monday afternoon. So they're doing a good job at promoting the event and have a really good player field. So that should be a fun one to watch.
Yeah, that'll be a good tournament to look out for. Houston is another one. It's a 250, plays on clay. Often you say that it's pretty different from a lot of the clay tournaments. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it doesn't play like the regular kind of clay. We had Tiafa win last year. It's going to be hard for him to defend his title. But yeah, that's going to be interesting. Who are some of those players playing at the Houston event on the ATP side? You mentioned Ben Shelton is in there.
Ben Shelton is the number one seed. Had Max Purcell and
Chris Eubanks went out. He was the fifth seed.
Bummer.
Giron, Francisco Cirindolo is playing. Yeah, Shelton, Tiafo. Echeverry is the fourth seed.
So there's.
Who's that?
Mickelson,
yeah, dangerous unseeded. So, yeah, there are some players playing, but, you know, chance for, I think, any of those guys to pick up a title, so it will be kind of interesting. Maybe Francisco Cirindolo likes his chances. He's kind of smartly found himself in the States playing a clay tournament, so we'll see what he can do out of it against the Americans, who can honestly struggle on clay. So that's, yeah. It just kind of is what it is. Monte Carlo soon. Well, I think we're going to get into all of that when Monte Carlo gets around. And that'll be fun in itself. For the culture segment, just to quickly go over a few different things, Novak split with, Ivanisevic, which is a huge split in the, kind of, I think not just for this year, but I think that's a partnership that I think goes down in tennis history for winning 12 majors with a guy that's over 30 years old. Tennis science is different now. I don't know if we're going to see that again. It's almost impossible to say at this point, but winning 12 slams post 30 years old is such an outlier for what we've seen so far. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't. So that is a huge split, and it'll be interesting to see who Novak goes to next. Did you have any thoughts on that split?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, I think my initial reaction was like, why, you know, like, it's been such a successful partnership. You won 3 out of the 4 slams last year. You got to all of the finals. Like, why? When you dig a little deeper, it sounds like there wasn't a personal rift, but maybe a professional rift, sort of a, you know, it can happen in business, in every walk of life, that you just don't agree on how to solve problems together anymore, on the approach anymore. And so it seemed like it was, you know, kind of a larger breakdown, and Djokovic has been pretty ruthless with everybody in his camp. I think it's an interesting choice heading into this very congested part of the season and not having a replacement coach ready to go. I'm like, is Boris Becker going to come back? I don't know. I think that's a piece where you're sort of like, aren't you going to need somebody? And why would you want to start a new relationship ahead of such an insane part of the season? You would have thought, like, if there'd be a coaching change, maybe after AO would have been the time to do it. It sounded like, and this is the tidbit I wanted to pick up on, that they had a bigger tiff or disagreement around Novak's approach to Indian Wells. And you may remember from 2 weeks ago where I sort of had a conversation with you about Novak seemed like he had oodles of time for fans and he was playing football on the lawn and he was sort of like, he didn't, having seen him up close and personal, didn't seem like this buttoned up world number one elite player that I'm used to seeing from Novak. It felt like a more relaxed energy. And I mentioned to you that I felt like as kind as it is to spend that much time with fans and people, it kind of, it felt like a bit of posturing or like something going on about being worried about his image and kind of who he is. And maybe that was the wrong interpretation of it. Perhaps it was literally like, I'm just not super motivated right now. Like at this age, at this time in my career, I'm going to kind of like slack off a little bit, or I'm not going to have the same level of intensity at this moment in time that I would around other moments in the calendar year. And so maybe there was an expectation there from a coaching perspective that just wasn't met. And Djokovic is like, I'm 36, 37 years old. Give me a break. Sometimes I you know, the level isn't, you know, where it should be. And so maybe that's kind of where things fell apart a little bit, but that was something I observed in Novak's general aura at Indian Wells, just felt much more laid back than what I'm used to seeing from him. And it feels like based on what's come out conversation wise around the split, that's kind of seemed to have been a sticking point and a part of the decision as to why they split up. So curious to see what's going to happen with that, to be honest.
Yeah. The motivation is an interesting thing to bring up, because now, you know, Rafa and Roger aren't playing. Like Rafa came back in Brisbane, but he's played one tournament the last like year and a half. Roger's out. That was largely his motivation for a long time. So it'll be interesting to see how his motivation does kind of go from here. Also the fact that he's achieved and is number one on so many stats in tennis is crazy.
Yeah.
I do remember you saying that to me a couple of weeks ago, and I have thought about it. I would say that I was probably a little bit not keen to what you're talking about, but I think that you're probably somewhat in the right, because it does seem like he's been distracting himself with a lot of things. I've seen a lot of extra curricular stuff going on.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say for sure what, you know, it's hard to, you can't get inside a player's head at all.
No.
But it does seem like there's something extra going on there. So I would agree with you. And it'll be interesting to see where it kind of goes from here. I don't know what the split was about. I heard that there was something going on in Indian Wells, that there's a big disagreement between the two, and it could have been about how he was handling things in that way specifically. I don't know exactly what it is. To me, honestly, I think I saw the split in a way in which I think Novak is probably at this point such a perfectionist, and is probably maybe a little bit worried about Sinner, the fact that he might be coming up and he might be a tough problem to deal with, and with Alcaraz as well. So I think that I think at this point, as crazy as it might sound, I think he's looking for almost a fresh start towards the end. Now that he, you know, didn't win at Wimbledon or the Australian Open, his two best majors, so young guys coming up who are only improving. He's losing sets all over the place, which just didn't used to happen. Lost to Demonor at United Cup. He lost to Luca Nardi at Indian Wells. So it hasn't been crazy. And he did have the season last year, but I think Novak maybe is sensing something, which doesn't come out of nowhere. And if that is the case, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I will say that on the general terms of what it feels like, I agree with the fact that I'd be worried if I was a Novak fan about Novak, because he said, I don't know about a coach. And right now is exactly when he should know what's going on and not be switching up. He's got the Olympics. He's got to defend US Open. Also got to defend the Wimbledon final, by the way. He's got so many things. This is one of his last best chances of a season to win a lot of you know, titles potentially when people don't usually do that at 37, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he's even mentioned like possibly not playing Wimbledon. That's been a part of the conversation. And I think, look, I mean, I think the guy, is older, and to give him some, you know, leeway in terms of, I've had disagreements over why he gets, you know, the ability to skip out on certain Masters tournaments and not play when they're supposed to be mandatory and kind of things like that. But I don't think at this stage, he honestly, I don't think he cares about defending points. I think he cares about the title tally. But I also think he cares about like his life maybe a little bit more than he used to. And so if he's not really like feeling up for it, or somebody in his camp is like giving him hell and he's not really in the mood, maybe he's making decisions now with a slightly shorter term mindset than maybe he would have a couple years ago when he has more longevity left in his career. I think it's too early to speculate, you know, like, is this the beginning of the end? Everybody wants to be the first to like call it. I think he will be motivated for this busy part of the season. I think especially we know when Novak's back is up against the wall that he's a guy that's going to come out swinging. So I don't think the motivation factor is going to be a question around Roland Garros, especially if Nadal is competing, especially if he gets the chance to play the Olympics. I think he's going to be motivated. But you sort of wonder if he's now going into that as best prepared as possible in a way that we have come to expect from him, you know, in terms of professionalism and approach to the sport. He's been the guy to always have his ducks in a row and to always come fully prepared. And so this is certainly an unusual setup for him to be in coming into this part of the season where you kind of wonder, like, are you best prepared? And I think that's where the question marks are going to fall, as opposed to the motivation being a factor at this particular point in the season. Whereas I think the motivation question marks were valid around Indian Wells period, where it's difficult to keep that intensity up for that long in your career. And so it's normal to see fluctuations. I just wonder if, I wonder what life is like without a coach on tour. And he's obviously been around long enough, but seems hard in my opinion.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see if he pulls that spot in as well. I don't know if he's gonna, you know, we've already had big name coaches actually to, I believe world number ones, at least Grand Slam champions with Ivan Nisevic. I don't remember if he got to number one, but two absolutely huge names in the game with Becker and Ivan Nisevic. It'll be interesting to see who he brings in, if not anybody, but I'm sure you saw as well, he's not even sure he's about which coach he's going to get, if he's going to get a coach at all. So yeah, that'll be interesting to see it itself. People are saying Federer. I'm not even going to entertain that at this point.
Definitely not.
No. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting year, I think is the best way to put it. And it was always going to be hard to follow up 2023, whether he's 36 or whether he's 20, you know?
Right.
So, absolutely. I agree with you. And, I still think it would be awesome to see Djokovic back at his best. With competing with Sinner and Alcaraz, cause man, we've gotten some good matches out of it. So, and also he's pushed Sinner and Alcaraz to such a great level. I've said this before, but having them around, Sinner and Alcaraz have really had to step up their game to an all-time level, which has really helped those two guys out. So the longer Novak's around, I think the better it is for the game. But yeah. And then last thing I'd like to end off on is there are going to be rules tested out in Madrid in doubles, which is there's going to be no sit downs in the first set in doubles. They're testing it out potentially to use in singles, right? So in the doubles Madrid tournament, they're testing out different rules to possibly do in the singles tournaments in the future. There's going to be no sit downs in the first set. There's also going to be a 15 second shot clock on rallies over three shots. And the biggest one for me is the entry system is going to suit singles players better. Which I think a lot of this is very inclined on putting the biggest singles name into doubles. And I understand that perspective of it, But for me, I just the no sit downs, it's going to hurt the older players playing doubles quite clearly. And also, it's great to have, you know, singles players that you want to see crowds showing up for doubles. That's that you need that. But I think if we would just market doubles better, I think we'd have that anyway. I think we're now getting to a point that if we take away the double specialists out of the game, I think doubles, we're going to see it fall apart out of tennis at the seams. I'm being honest. That's how I see it. I think doubles is at risk of losing itself completely. And that's how I see it. And I would not like to see that happen. I don't think it's going to be instant, but especially with rules like this, I think that's where we're going. And we're going to a place where it's mostly singles professionals and not, you know, doubles players playing at their best, which is what, you know, elevates the sport of doubles, which is, I think, a different sport in itself almost, to its like highest level. So I'm just worried to see that. Also, absolutely hope it doesn't come into singles. The fact that we're shortening changeovers in itself is crazy. And the fact that there would be no changeovers in the first set. I mean, why are we doing these changes when there's so many other obvious changes to add, and we're just like shortening the game in all the wrong ways. There's so many other things that we could do. It's not taking the athletes, you know, into account to make them perform at their physical best, which you need for tennis.
Oh, I 100% agree. I think a minute sit down is not the issue. Like, that's not why people aren't watching doubles. I certainly don't want to see that coming into singles, especially at the intensity that this sport is played at nowadays. To me, again, this feels like some 50-plus-year-old person who doesn't understand how to market to Gen Z and younger thinks that, oh, these young people have no attention span, so let's make everything shorter and quicker because that's why nobody's watching.
Yeah.
No. You guys are not marketing your sports in the right way. You're not understanding social media. You're not understanding the conversations that need to be had in terms of rights holders and how rights are used to distribute clips of the game globally. You're not understanding how to actually market this sport to young people. And the problem is not the game. It's not like tennis is suddenly unfashionable or not a cool sport because there's some other thing that everybody, you know, is doing. That's not been the issue. Tennis has been around for generation after generation after generation. Young people are not engaged because you're not reaching them in the right ways. And tennis is a sport that literally is so behind in their ability to market themselves. And so for me, this is a cop-out. This is a lazy way to think about making changes and adjustments. I can't get on board with some of the things that they've been throwing out there. And it just shows that they not only don't they understand the marketing question, but they don't understand the needs and requirements of these top level players who deserve their 1 minute rest. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Why should it be such a big deal? And it's another thing of, I think, making everything quicker, making everything shorter, you know, making everything as easy as possible to what is obvious that people are looking for at the moment. But I don't think what you're saying is, I don't think even Gen Z wants that. I think we're just not getting that from all of the biggest media and, you know, sports. If we had access to these things and, you know, and we were just, yeah, like you're saying, marketing it better and showing the best of what the sport has to offer and showing, you know, rather than shortening it up and taking the easy way out, which is usually the wrong one, and adding it, making it less double specialist and more singles players and shortening changeovers and making it, you know, it's a way of, you know, filling in holes in the road, but adding hills where the holes are. It's like, Now the cars are just flying off the roads and then suddenly there's chaos. So that I think is what we're seeing. And we don't need to do this. Stop shortening changeovers and let the players have the rest and let, you know, the best of tennis shine rather than taking away what's at the heart of it for what I think is immediately more, you know, seems exciting or, you know, palpable or, you know, accessible to people. Like, let's, you know, give an effort and, you know, try to challenge ourselves to make tennis the best of what it can be rather than in the moment, immediately making it fun, because that will just, I think, ruin the sport altogether. So Thank you guys for joining in to the podcast. I've been Anthony Hirsch.
I'm Eliza Westgate.
Thank you guys for watching. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like all that. Quality Shot just hit 10K subscribers. We're going for 20K. I appreciate everybody who's watching. So thank you guys for joining in. Like always, I'll see you guys at the next one.